This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. You're listening to another episode of What If Malaysia, an 8-episode mini-series where we explore what Malaysia could look like with specific progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Dashan Johan, and previously on the show, we asked the question, what if Malaysia legalizes abortion on demand? And today we'll be exploring what if Malaysia legalizes sex work. But as always, I can't do this alone. So joining me on the show today is Jurnal Tani Arumugam, an independent researcher, women's rights activist, and she also recently conducted a community-based research on the experiences of sex workers in Malaysia during the pandemic. Welcome to the show, Jenna. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Dashran. Thank you for this invitation. And I really welcome the opportunity to talk about communities that hardly get, you know, attention because of the kind of work that they do.
Definitely. Jenna, perhaps you can start by explaining what constitutes sex work in Malaysia.
So sex work, from the definition of the women that we have interviewed, is basically offering sexual services in exchange for money. So they will set a particular token amount for the kind of services that they perform. And usually it is determined by the sex worker herself, or it is done in negotiation with the client or the customer that they are negotiating the price with.
Okay, and what are the laws currently governing sex work in Malaysia? Because we know that it's a little bit murky. We know that it's a bit convoluted. It's a bit confusing. So maybe from your vantage point, can you tell us what are the laws currently governing sex work in Malaysia?
Okay, so when we talk about sex work, okay, we're using a term that is affirmative for sex workers, right? So we use the term sex work. However, the definition, the legal definition in our country is the term prostitution, which we find extremely problematic. So prostitution in per se is not an offence unless it falls under sections of the Malaysian Penal Code 327. So basically it means any exploitation of a person with the purpose of prostitution, okay? Or 372A says, living on the earnings of prostitution. 372B says soliciting or importunes for the purpose of prostitution. Of course, it doesn't define what soliciting is. So if we look at the kind of issues that come with soliciting, we've noticed that the police have started infiltrating things like WhatsApp groups and then, you know, arresting women who are offering sex work in these WhatsApp groups. But exactly what soliciting means has not really been challenged in court, all right? And we don't have any landmark cases that actually look at this whole terminology of soliciting. It has never been challenged in court. So, and these sections, because they are colonial, right?
They were
set up during the colonial period, okay? It's very focused on pimps and brothels, or if the sex worker is caught red-handed on the street, or is she caught in a brothel, right? So if we look at, with the passage of time, a lot of things have changed with sex work. A lot of the work is now being done, conducted online, and because of the nature of the pandemic, etc., people are having different kinds of arrangements with the way they offer these services. And if we look at Section 372 of the Penal Code, whoever knowingly lives or wholly or in part of the earnings of the prostitution of another person shall be punished with imprisonment of a term which may extend up to 15 years with whipping, and so shall be liable to a fine. So usually, you know, from our research, what we found was a lot of the sex workers were providing for their families.
Right.
So if we look at this context, and we look at the way the law is so rigid in its interpretation, it's very problematic. And it seems to show that the women have no agency. Agency here means, you know, that they're able to work for themselves, they're able to get clients for themselves and offer these services. So a lot of things have changed and the law has not really kept up with it. And, you know, pretty much it's an archaic law. So we have another law that comes into this context, which has to do with HIV/AIDS. Okay, so the Prevention and Control of Infectious Diseases Act 1988 S12 says, it is an offense for a person who knows or has reason to believe that they have HIV to do any act which they know or have reason to believe is likely to lead to the spread of HIV. And of course, there is this very misleading idea that people think all sex workers are infected with HIV and they are super spreaders of diseases. And if we look in the context, I mean, if we understand from the context of the recent pandemic, the government made a big show of, you know, highlighting how many sex workers were actually arrested during the pandemic. They made the national statistics, right? Daily they were publishing this number of people were actually arrested for sex work. So it goes into that whole idea that sex workers spread disease and they're somehow very infectious and problematic. Then we have the Sharia law, which affects Muslim women, right? So state-level Sharia law operates to criminalize Muslim citizens who engage in sex work, okay? So there are two types of offenses that can be applied against sex workers and their clients. One is zina, which applies to sex work between unmarried persons, and khalwat, which is a less serious offense that prohibits Muslims from being alone with someone of the opposite sex other than their spouse or relative. As a result, the persecution of sex workers by the police and religious authorities for Muslims is a direct result of the criminalization of sex work. So raids become a big problem for sex workers working in brothels or working on their own. So the law actually enables the authorities to crack down on what they deem as sex work. This is the framework that we're dealing with when we talk about sex work in Malaysia.
Okay, but have these laws actually been successful in preventing sex work in Malaysia? Because it seems to me that in Malaysia, that despite its confusing legal status, sex work is still a thing in Malaysia. In fact, it's not even this big secret, right? It's easy to know where the unofficial red light areas are in KL, for example. It's also easy to know which massage parlors, you know, offer quote unquote special services. So have these laws actually been successful?
To be very nuanced about this answer, Dashan, I would look at this in two ways. Mm-hmm. Because there is a need, there is a service. And sex work is something that people have been doing way before these laws were created. And sex work was something that provided people with livelihood. And on top of that, sex work was something that, you know, in a cultural context existed way before these laws existed. You know, there were sections of the community where there were sex workers, there were places that you could go to get the services of these people. And they lived in communities, they lived in certain areas. There was a certain set of codes by which they operated. So you have the colonial administration, right, which comes in and then it looks at regulating a state or regulating a particular area of interest for them. So primarily, control of human beings are very important. Controlling human beings and ensuring that the colonial project of making money for the colonial powers is very important. So regulating sex workers was part of the way they used laws, okay? So they didn't want brothels to be unregistered. They needed for brothels to be registered. So they needed laws to regulate brothels, right? So if the brothel was regulated, they were registered, and the number of women working there were accounted for, they could, you know, basically control how this was actually managed, right? Mm-hmm. And the state had a lot, the colonial state had a lot to do with the supply and demand of sex workers. So if you look at the way the migrant workers came into Malaya, a lot of them were young men and they lived in very, very harsh conditions. So sex work was seen as a way for them to control the agitation of their workers, right? So getting women to migrate to Malaya for the purpose of sex work was something that the colonial government was party to, right? And these regulations came about because people were becoming a lot more independent. Brothels were being set up. And there was a form of organizing that was going on, which the state, the colonial state, was slowly losing control over. So this was one of the main reasons why they had these kinds of laws.
Right. But the problem now is that there is no regulation, right? I mean, there are laws in the penal code, but the problem that we are facing here in Malaysia is that we know that all these things are happening. Like, we know that sex work is real. We know that sex work exists in Malaysia. Yet there is no regulation. There is no proper standard of practice, official standard of practice. And that is the problem, right? We need to reach a point where it is legal, and so that it can be regulated with proper laws, you know, after engaging with NGOs and whatnot.
Well, I would like to look at it from the perspective of sex workers. Yes, they need protection because the nature of sex work today is, you know, it's highly criminalized, you know, so they face a lot of risks from raids. Authorities can be very abusive. In fact, we collected a lot of case studies of human rights violations of sex workers in the hands of authorities. We also documented a lot of violations by their customers, their clients, also their controllers, that means the brothel owners or the pimps, right? We also looked at how, you know, women were denied necessary services by, say, healthcare providers, public healthcare providers. So the nature of this work and the way the criminalization of it actually puts these women at greater risk, and it doesn't help anyone. And of course, as you rightly pointed out, everybody knows that it exists. And of course, as long as there's a need, most definitely there will be the service that is provided, right? So women are able to find these jobs because there is a need, and people do, so you know, come to them, and you know, they do negotiate the price. But the thing is, there are a lot of other problems that are inherent with this particular process because women can't really speak up about it.
And can we talk about the consequences of sex work not being legal and regulated in Malaysia from the perspective of the clients that go to them? What are the consequences that a client might face in Malaysia when they choose to visit, let's say, a brothel, for example?
Okay, so some of the groups that we worked with, right, that do outreach to sex workers, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the issues that they have brought to us is the fact that, you know, they have been doing a lot of education for sex workers. In fact, if you look at HIV transmission, right, among, you know, for example, transgender sex workers, you know, they are actually really good advocates for safe sex. So we interviewed about, you know, 19 over women. All of them advocated for safe sex with their clients. In fact, they buy their own condoms and supply to their clients. Mm-hmm. When commissioned for work. So when we look at clients and how clients can be protected, of course, if there is regulations, of course, you know, you have to declare your status, whether you're HIV, you know, for any STI, for instance, you know, that would be very important, mm-hmm. right? But in this instance, we have a lot of clients who actually are willing to pay a lot more for sex work where you don't for unsafe sex, you know. So right. If you don't use a condom, you're actually paid double that amount that mm-hmm. you would get if you used a condom. And you know, the places where we went and interviewed women, the brothels actually have a condom policy. In fact, during the pandemic, many of these brothels were insisting that clients used face masks, etc.
Right.
Okay, so they came up with their own form of, you know, ensuring that their workers were safe. So you can see, even though, you know, there is no proper regulations by the state for the purpose of protecting everyone, there are ways that that the women develop their own agency. In fact, you know, in some of our trainings, we actually taught women the importance of safe sex. I must say, their understanding of sex work is safe sex is very high because of the great work of organizations like Malaysian AIDS Council that does a lot of HIV transmission prevention programs because it is led by peers and peers educate sex workers about the need for safe sex. Of course, I agree. Regulation would protect clients, most definitely. But at the end of the day, the negotiation of safety happens between a very empowered sex worker and a client that has some level of awareness of protecting themselves.
All right. On that note, we do need to hit for a very quick break. After a break, we will be exploring what Malaysia could look like if we do legalize sex work. We'll be back with more on What If Malaysia, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode mini-series where we examine what Malaysia could look like with specific progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Dashran Johan, and with me on the show today virtually on Skype is General Tani Arumugam, a researcher, women's rights activist, and she also recently conducted a community-based research on the experiences of sex workers in Malaysia during the pandemic. And what we are doing today is exploring what if Malaysia legalizes sex work. Jenna, perhaps we can start the second part of the show by exploring what are some of the social stigmas attached to sex work in Malaysia?
Okay, so when we look at the whole situation of how sex workers themselves look at sex work, right? Of course, they're very, very sensitive about the fact that it is frowned upon by society. A lot of sex workers don't tell their families that they actually do sex work. And if they are outed, you know, they become extremely humiliated. And on top of that, we find that sex workers generally, even the ones who have families and you're supporting their families with sex work, right? We had a lot of problems getting them to actually say that, you know, yeah, you know, this is how I support my family. You also have women who do seasonal sex work. So when school season is open, women have to do sex work in order to, you know, cope with the increasing costs of schooling, etc. So in this sense, you know, we want to look at the societal pressures that are on women, you know, because they blame the women rather than they look at the social context. And a lot of the women that we spoke to talked a lot about economic hardship. A lot of them were not able to get good jobs. Majority of the women we spoke to did not have, 50% of them had not finished school. Most of them had primary school education. They couldn't get jobs. And if you look at the increasing costs of living today, you know, earning 1,200 ringgit was not sufficient for them. They are also, you know, responsible for aging parents. They had to ensure that, you know, their income level was enough, right? But the kind of stigma that they face, you know, usually you find them hiding a lot of the details of where they work. Sometimes, you know, when we talk to women who were doing work by themselves, right, we ask them, okay, does anybody know that you've gone to see a client, you know? And most of them would say, no, we don't tell anyone that we've gone to see. So, you know, there's a lot of risks involved as well because, you know, they don't want anyone to find out that they're doing this. Keeping this identity secret is so important for them because of the way society looks at them, you know, and the problems that are associated with it, like discrimination, and then you have familial pressures, etc.
So, the Netherlands is one of the first and, you know, I believe most well-known countries in the world which has fully legalized, quote-unquote, just to use the legal term here, prostitution since 2000, where sex work is recognized as a legal profession and the brothels are regulated the same way as any other businesses. And studies have shown that, and this is what's really interesting to me, right? Studies have shown that there has been a dramatic decline in number of rape and sexual assault cases among sex workers. Quality of life of sex workers have improved. When even the spread of STDs and other sexually transmitted diseases are more controlled because of this regulation. Can you break down how the Netherlands has benefited from this approach?
One very important thing that we need to understand about, you know, deregulation is the fact that the women were very organized. Sex workers are organized. So organizations of sex workers actually pushed for these reforms, all right? And when it comes from the community and the community is empowered to make the kind of changes that they require and the kind of laws and legal frameworks that makes it possible for them to do what they need to do and the engagement of the state in ensuring that the rights of these women, these communities are protected is very important. So if you take the context of the women in Netherlands, they were able to get compensation from the councils and from the state, because they could not do sex work for almost 6 to 7 months, right? So they were actually given compensation. So that's a very successful example of how not criminalizing sex work, you know, happens. However, we need to understand that these are very empowered individuals, the sex workers that we're talking about. And their organizations are very political in nature, okay? And the communities or the society where they live in is also very much more aware of the kind of issues that happen. So if we compare it to, say, the context of Malaysia, mm-hmm. the conservatism that we have in society is very problematic. So if you have sex workers actually speaking up, you know, they would be judged first and foremost before, you know, the issues that they face is even, you know, taken seriously. The awareness level of our society and, you know, the scapegoating of sex workers because, you know, they are deemed as immoral is very problematic. Those are the things that we need to address first. And those are the huge barriers for women to speak up.
I am curious though, do you think that if we legalize and start to, you know, have proper frameworks like the Netherlands, do you think on the flip side, this could then reduce the stigma that are placed upon sex workers?
Well, as I told you, our society is extremely conservative. If the state were to immediately deregulate, right, which is what we want, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
The first thing we really need to fix is the perspective of the community, the society. When they are often very, very regressive in their perspective, you know, they're conservative, they bring in religion, cultural norms, which are very harmful to women into the context of a discussion, right, on issues of rights. There is really no space for the women to actually be able to speak about the issues. So when you talk about deregulation, Dashran, it cannot just come from the state. The state cannot decide suddenly, okay, I'm just going to decide that as of today, this number of lawmakers are going to, you know, say that we will abolish this particular law and we're going to have a law that protects sex workers. It doesn't work in isolation like that. There's a lot of awareness that needs to happen among various members of society, politicians, media, the whole works, all right? And then we need to empower sex workers to speak up in order for them to create a safe space for them to be able to address their issues. And this just doesn't involve sex workers, but the whole spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. So when we use the word deregulate, at least, you know, what we want to achieve is not criminalizing sex work, which puts them at the greatest danger. Right now, if you ask me realistically, Jana, do you think deregulation work? Of course it will work. But I think right now in the context of reality, you know, what works on the ground in Malaysia, stopping the criminalization would work, right? Stop making women, you know, feel afraid, you know, like, for example, as you talked about, you mentioned earlier, clients, you know, violating women, you know, reducing HIV transmission. Of course, you know, women would, you know, come in and give data. It's very difficult to collect data of sex workers in Malaysia. You know, and in fact, you know, they don't have actual numbers, even, you know, with all the outreach work that's being done by Malaysian AIDS Council, it's more about education rather than politically empowering sex workers to speak up for their rights.
Right. The Netherlands is also known for its red light district as one of its most frequented tourist attractions in the country and has even contributed significantly to its local economy. Do you think it's important that we start looking at sex work from the perspective of economy, health, so on and so forth, instead of looking at it through like this moral prism?
Okay. The moral prism is basically used to basically control the women, which is what, you know, the colonial powers intended to do. But in terms of what we need today, we really need to look at it from the perspective of protecting the rights of women, right? And ensuring, like a lot of the sex workers we met, you know, some of them were even 67 years old and still doing sex work. You know, they don't have social protection. They don't have an insurance plan. They don't have a retirement plan. It's actually very frightening because what happens to these women when, you know, they can no longer perform sex work? They probably become destitute, you know, and become homeless. And it's an issue for the state. So in terms of understanding what the women need, you know, it is very important to be able to first of all, you know, document how many women there are, where are the spaces where these things are happening. And it has to be done with the empowerment of sex workers themselves. Yes, you can use NGOs as intermediaries, but the fear that the sex workers have of the state needs to dissipate for them to be able to do these kind of things, right? And when they're able to actually speak up and they're able to form organizations, and then they're able to, you know, provide the right kind of feedback, right meaning feedback that they feel the state needs to take into account too, then I think it becomes a workable solution. And then we can talk about economic benefit, you know, and like all work, right? They need protection, they need healthcare services, they need, you know, right now, you know, even getting them access in public healthcare becomes very problematic because of the kind of discrimination that they face. So this is why organizations like Malaysian AIDS Council enables these services to be made available to them. By working with the Ministry of Health, they're able to do outreach work and bring these women in to do the kind of regular testing, like every 6 months, to ensure their status is you know, they're able to determine the HIV status, they're given education, they're given free condoms, you know. Right now, if anyone is caught with a condom in their bag, you know, they could be accused of, you know, doing sex work, you know.
Are you
carrying
serious?
A bag of condom. Yes. So when raids happen, right, the policemen go in, the first thing they look for are condoms. And then when they raid the room, they look for condoms, they look for sex toys, they look for lubricants. And, you know, this is how they determine that the woman is conducting sex.
Jenna, do you think it's important that we normalize sex work, like how we are talking about it right now, right? We are using sex work, not prostitution. Do you think it's important to normalize that? Because as we touched on a little bit earlier, right now, sex work is either, you know, this thing where the women are suffering and they have no other option and they are left to fend for themselves and their last final effort, they decide, let's be a sex worker, which is important and true for a lot of people. On the other side, it's, you know, these women with so-called loose morals and they're criminals and blah, 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 and that's why they are becoming sex workers. Is it important for us to frame sex work as a normal work? Because there are sex workers who want to become sex workers because they want to become a sex worker. They're not necessarily suffering. You know, it's their choice. They want to do it. Do you think that is important? Do you think is that we need to start looking at things that way?
Yes, most definitely. I agree with you, Dashrin, because I think the moralizing of this issue becomes very, very problematic. You know, when you moralize something, it becomes a wrong or a right. It doesn't look at why it exists. You know, if there is, and when it becomes a wrong, then there's a lot of shadow that comes with it. You have to hide it. You have to lie about it. You have to, you know, take very strict actions in order to control it. So the whole approach becomes very problematic. So if sex work were to be recognized as actual work, because it is work, you know, you do need to do certain preparations. You do perform a service, and it does provide a particular kind of tangible level of fulfillment
right.
for the client.
Definitely.
Then it should be recognized as such, you know. And whether women want to take it on as, you know, a career of choice, it should be up to them. Again, then we go back to that whole idea of, you know, regulating women's bodies.
On the flip side, some argue that legalized sex work is a perfect breeding ground for sex trafficking. And, you know, it turns women into products that can be sold and bought. What is your perspective on this?
Okay, like all kinds of human labor, right? You know, like this is the same kind of issue that they talk about when we talk about migration for work, etc. If you make it available and clear for people to migrate in a safe manner and they are aware of the kind of risks that they're taking, I think it becomes a viable way of, you know, finding work and, you know, developing yourself, etc., you know, finding economic empowerment. But in this sense, we've had a lot of successful cases, especially in India, where groups of sex workers have actually reduced trafficking in their in the areas where they work. In fact, they notice that a child's being trafficked, they become the first first responders, you know, they're the eyes and the ears of the community. Then they're able to inform the authorities that such a thing has actually happened. In fact, empowered sex workers will be able to, you know, become, in a way, they can actually prevent, you know, sex trafficking from happening, because one, they want to empower the people who come into the industry. They also have a set of rules by which the industry works. And, you know, they know exactly how to go about bringing people into the industry. And if you look at, and especially in the case of our research, a lot of the sex workers actually went to their friends and they got involved in sex work. And the kind of negotiation skills and tricks of the trade that they learned were actually from their friends who've been doing it before them. So in that sense, you know, if you have strong sex workers, organized sex workers, most definitely they can prevent things like sex trafficking, you know. Most definitely they would prevent violence from happening to people within their own community. In fact, you also see incidences of violence against clients and all that reducing because sex workers have a mechanism where they alert each other about the behavior of certain clients. This happens within brothels also. This happens within, you know, particular groups, you know, that they are able to send out messages. So now they are more interconnected, you know. They can even take pictures of clients who can act in an aggressive manner. They can use their devices, you know, to document violence, etc. So in different countries, we see that it actually empowers women who are doing the job, who are doing this work. And, you know, they act as a protective barrier from things like sex trafficking.
Jenna, let's imagine or speculate for a while. How exactly will the legalization of sex work, how do you think it could transform our country? Because when we look at it, you know, when we think about it, even a country like Singapore, which generally we look at as a draconian country when it comes to social issues, you know, it's not exactly a country that necessarily values freedom and liberation, right? Even Singapore has somewhat legalized sex work, right?
Krishna, they didn't legalize sex work. They regulate places that make sex work available. It's interesting that you said this, right? Very excitingly, the National University of Singapore actually conducted an excellent research on the impact of the COVID-19 on sex workers and the adversities that they faced. So the state actually gave money to the most prominent university in the country to conduct research among sex workers. So they recognize, you know, that sex workers were affected by the COVID situation. And regulation actually enables women, the state to monitor, you know, because Singapore is very particular about the HIV transmission. It's all about productivity. It's ensuring that people are not transmitting diseases. So in that sense, they're being practical about it. But if you ask me if women are, you know, organized, I mean, women are empowered to speak up politically for their needs, of course, it's not there.
Right.
But from a health perspective, yes, these guys are actually a lot more progressive than us because they are practical people, right? Mm-hmm. And they know that these women are actually supplying a need. And, you know, of course, there's also the class issue where, you know, most of the sex workers are catering to migrant workers who work in Singapore. And there's a large, you know, there's a huge population of migrant workers in Singapore. And apparently, they are servicing this community. So the regulation does not necessarily mean their rights are recognized. It just means it's easier for the state to monitor sex work. So that's why when you talk about regulation, Kashran, I'm looking at how empowered the sex worker is to make the choices that she makes. For example, I take on an employment. Do I have a union? Are my rights as a worker protected? Are my best interests provided for? Am I able to get particular social securities that I require in order to do my work? We don't have that kind of discussion when we talk about deregulation.
So I guess the ultimate question then is, are we ready for it? Is Malaysia ready to legalize sex work? Or at least not, even if we don't, you know, take the approach that Netherlands did, maybe something like Singapore? What do you think?
I think we really must go that way. At least, you know, for the time being, let's look at regulating this industry in the sense that, you know, women have protection. Women are not exposed to abuses by authorities or their clients or their controllers, you know. So we want to ensure, regardless of what the women do, you know, they have a level of protection. And, you know, not protecting them leads to further exploitation. And they take, you know, unmitigated risks, which actually puts us in a lot, in a bigger problem at the end of the day. I think it's necessary to regulate. I think it's necessary to ensure that women feel safe enough to come and say, yes, I do sex work. Please allow me to have, you know, enable the public health services to provide the kind of health care that I need. For example, free pap smears, free STI tests, HIV tests. Right now, it is only enabled by, say, for example, with the work that the good work that the Malaysian AIDS Council is doing. But otherwise, you know, like healthcare providers, public healthcare providers are not very friendly. And the people, the personnel who work in this hospital are actually very antagonistic and harsh towards women, especially if they know that they are sex workers. In fact, you know, they treat them as if they are diseased. You know, they don't touch them. They're very rough with them. Women have reported many of their experiences, you know, as such. So, yes, let's start with regulating it, you know, ensuring that women feel safe enough to say that they're doing this. And if they have problems, they can come up and report it and allow them to set up organizations, maybe even, you know, as far-fetched as may sound, unions to protect their rights.
Well, on that note, Jenna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kashran. Thank you very much.
That was Janarthani Arumugam, an independent researcher and women's rights activist, answering the question, what if Malaysia legalizes sex work? So if you missed any part of this conversation or the first few episodes of the series, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. You just have to search BFM, Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and you've been listening to What If Malaysia on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.